I'm Joe Pardavila, and you are listening to the Forbes Books Podcast. Quick question. How many serial entrepreneurs do you know who have also starred in one of the greatest TV shows of all time? I can't think of many, except for today's guest. His name is John O'Hurley, and he's best known for his iconic role of Jay Peterman on Seinfeld. But he's also a serial entrepreneur who's been involved with multiple businesses, including Gold Seal Industries. We're going to talk about that, plus the National Dog Show, which he'll be hosting on Thanksgiving Day for NBC, and we'll find out what are the chances of a Seinfeld reunion. John, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm doing fabulous. How are you?
I'm good. And boy, what a busy time of year for you. Coming up, you've got the National Dog Show. It's hard to become a tradition in America. You know, you had the Thanksgiving Day parade, you have the Christmas tree lighting, but the National Dog Show has become a Thanksgiving Day tradition. How did that happen? Because it's so hard to break through to do something like that.
Well, it's a funny story because it begins with that wonderful old film called Best in Show. Mm-hmm. It was a parody of the Westminster Dog Show. Well, John Miller, who was head of NBC Sports, went home and took that home and watched it over the weekend. This was back in 2002. He watched it and just laughed his head. I've watched it twice, actually. He came in Monday morning to NBC, to the morning meeting, and said, I know what we're going to do with that two-hour slice in between the parade, the Macy's parade, and football. He says, we're going to do a dog show. Well, they about laughed him out of the office. But sure enough, by the end of the day, his persistence ensued, and he ended up with the Kennel Club of Philadelphia licensing one of their shows at the National Dog Show. Purina came on as a presenting sponsor. Then he called me on Tuesday morning out in Los Angeles, and I picked up the phone, and he said, woof, woof.
And so I have to ask, of all the people that have connected to the NBC universe, why was John O'Hurley one of the first calls he made?
Well, I had done a lot of work hosting for NBC Sports, a lot of, things that they do privately that you're not aware of. But they always would ask me to come along, and they said jump. I said, how high? And, honestly, to begin with, I looked at it and I said, what the heck am I getting myself into? Because, it's a world I don't know. So it would be like, Jim Nantz doing the International Cornhole Championships.
And I wonder, because that's sort of like, that was sort of a bit in the Best in Show, how like, some people know nothing about it. So did you have, because, as an actor, I know that when it comes to roles, actors love, their most cherished part of the process is that research and trying to dig into the character. So I can imagine when you didn't just step in willy-nilly for that first, you didn't go to Philadelphia without any preparation. What was it like getting ready for that first dog show?
Oh, it was, it really was kind of a sloppy, I didn't know what we were doing. I really, nobody could really explain to me, because remember, NBC was learning along with it too. Mm. So it was a kind of an interesting little learn as you go. Fortunately, my co-host is the most knowledgeable man in the world of dogs, David Fry. And so it was, a wonderful teaching platform for me. But it gave me an opportunity to say some of the stupidest things I've ever said in my life. The first year that they brought the English sheepdog up to the judge, and if you don't know what an old English sheepdog is, it's 80 pounds of hair and 2 pounds of actual dog. This elegantly gowned woman. And she walks around to the back of the dog. She starts putting her hands all over the back of the dog. And I turned to my co-host, David. I said, what is she doing? Can you explain? He said, John, she's putting her hands on the dog. To make sure that, to check the shoulders and the hips and make sure that they align with the written specification of what the perfect old English sheepdog should be. He said, because you can hide a really bad dog with a really good haircut. And I said, you're telling me I went to junior prom. And so she walks around to the front of the dog and she starts picking through all of the hair on the dog's head. I said, David, what is she doing now? He said, John, she's looking for the eyes to gauge the attentiveness of the dog. I said, really? I said, well, if she picks through all of that hair and she finds only one eye, she's got the wrong end of the dog. Things I had no business doing, huh?
Did you get any notes afterwards? Be like, hey, John, maybe not so much the butt stuff? Or what was the feedback you were getting?
No, but Monday morning in USA Today in the sports section, they had quotes of the weekend from the other sports commentators, and right up at the top was O'Hurley and the wrong end of the dog.
I love that. And I'd love to get your take on this because I am sort of late to the game by having a dog. Long story short, when I was a little kid, we lost a dog in an accident, and my father was one of these extremists, is like, if one bad thing happened, we'll never do it again. So I went from having a dog at 4 years old to then not having another dog till I was in my 40s. So I was never like a dog lover or dog person. And maybe I'm wrong by this, but I feel like more than ever, people love dogs at this point in history than any other time, because you can't go anywhere. Like I live down in Charleston, South Carolina. I think it's the law that you have to be with child or with dog, or you're not allowed out. Everyone's got a dog. Are you seeing that as well?
In the presence of your child or your pet. That's interesting. You know, it is. I would say that yes, the preoccupation with dogs have grown, and I think the pandemic made those numbers swell even more because people were, you know, locked down. They didn't have anywhere to go and no companionship. And so, you know, they went to the shelters, and they emptied the shelters in many respects. There was a great increase in dog ownership during the pandemic. But it was also moving in that direction years prior to that. I think that people just realize the tremendous support, the stress release, of pet ownership. Certainly a large responsibility and being responsible to take care of another life, but it's also a very, very rewarding thing as well.
Yeah, I mean, I was working in morning radio in New York for like 20-something years, so the idea of me having to worry about a dog to me was just like, it was too overwhelming. But once I walked away from that and had like a regular 9-to-5 type job, my wife and I got a dog, and he's a long-haired dachshund. His name is Nathan, and I remember, John, when we first got him, so it had been years since either of us had dogs, and we got him as a puppy. He was probably like 3 months old, and we get him into our home, and all he does is pee everywhere. He just pees everywhere. And I was, you know, I was doing deep dives in YouTube videos and reading articles about, you know, house train a dog. And all of them to a person, John said, the way you do it is you reward them when they do the right thing. Well, John, this little son of a bitch would not do the right thing ever. Like, he would not go outside. He was afraid to pee outside. So it took like 2 or 3 months. And I will tell you, John, those early dark days of having Nathan, I was questioning every decision I made in my life. I'm like, did we do the wrong thing? I mean, is this dog ever going to pee outside?
And more importantly, is it us?
No doubt. I was, because to the thing my wife and I kept saying was like, are other people having the same problem we are having? Because this doesn't seem right. And eventually he snapped out of it. And you've probably heard this before, but what I've come to find out, John, is with dogs is you don't train them, they train you. So we got to the stage where he was eventually learned to go outside and everything like that. And it just changed everything. But it's like, once you get over that hump of like those early sort of like potty training and sit stay stuff, it's like, it's such a joy having a dog in your life and having them just lick your face off in the morning and all that comes with it. It's like, John, I feel like, my God, I there was such a large part of my life without a dog. I'm like, man, that's one of the regrets in my life, that I didn't have a dog for 20 years.
I mean, it is true, but please remember that your parents and my parents had to live through several years of you soiling half a dozen diapers a day.
True.
There are people that had to live with the potty training as well.
John, but my rebuttal to that is, well, because my brother actually had a baby at the same time we got a dog, and I said to him, hey, listen, the baby has diapers. Dogs don't have diapers. So I had that on him, so...
Yeah, it does. But you're right. Once you get past that stage, it's an enormous. The dogs do enormous things for us, and just in terms of just stress relief and rounding off the edges in our otherwise brittle lives.
Yeah,
they do great things, and yet they know not what they do.
And I know not every dog show is alike. So can you give us a quick little preview about this year's show and anything we should be looking out for? You know, anything?
Part of the experience of this dog show is actually being there for it. It's a benched show. A benched show means that all of the owners, the dogs, the handlers, everybody has to remain there backstage from 7 in the morning until 5 or 6 at night. So, so consequently, the 10, 20, 30,000 people that will show up at the arena there in Oaks, Pennsylvania, they'll be able to walk up and down the aisles, and they'll see upwards of 2,000 of the best dogs you've in the country. 200 different breeds of dogs. And most people growing up in their lives have, you know, only seen four or five different breeds in the neighborhood, that type of thing. But there are 207 that are registered with the AKC.
Wow.
So it's a wonderful interactive experience. Additionally, they'll be judged in their group competition, and then seven will be left, and those seven will be eligible for the Best in Show competition, which is at the end.
And John, I was curious because one of the things that, you know, obviously a lot of people know you for Seinfeld, and I don't want to regurgitate any Seinfeld stories here, but the one thing I'd love to get your take on is when I was a kid growing up in the 80s, and you probably remember this too, John, when you were a kid, you grew up on old TV shows. Like if you were sick home from school or during summer vacation, basically the only thing that the local stations would play were reruns. So I grew up watching Brady Bunch and the Partridge Family and I Dream of Jeannie, stuff that had been off the air for like 20, 30 years. So those shows were introduced to a new generation of fans. And now I see you're seeing these stories, John, and I apologize if you've already read this before, that Generation Z absolutely loves Seinfeld.
Yeah, it's really been it's been extraordinary, and especially because Netflix picked it up, which made it cool. And also, it made it available for binge watching, which is a very important thing. People want to watch 5, 6, 7 episodes at a time, you know, and you couldn't do that on syndication. All of a sudden, the show has developed a brand new audience. My son, who's soon to be 16 in a few weeks, he and his friends watch Seinfeld all the time. In fact, when he comes out for dinner time, I'll be watching, you know, the Boston Red Sox or a Celtics game or something like that. Or news or whatever, and around the dinner table. And he says, "Dad, let's watch a Seinfeld." Okay. He's seen them all, and he loves them all, and he just continues to watch them over and over again, as do most people. They, you know, it's kind of like home cooking. You know, it's that you just like it. It's like a slice of meatloaf.
Totally. And it's funny because many times I interviewed Jon Bon Jovi, and the one thing that he noticed was that over the years, you know, initially his fan base was teenage girls, and obviously they grew along with him. And then one day he realized that all these teenage girls were now mature women, and they were bringing their teenage girls to their concerts, and then they became fans. So is it weird for you, and I know you've been showbiz for a long time, but is it weird for you that a show that's been off the air for, 20 years at this point, it's over 20 years, that you're now running into people that are saying, "Hey, I was just watching Seinfeld." I mean, it still has to feel weird, right?
Wonderfully weird. And let me tell you, the day that stops is the day the music dies. You know, because as you say, there aren't that too many more generations that Bon Jovi is going to be able to celebrate what he did. And so it's nice to be, you know, in the presence of people that still appreciate the gift of laughter, and the fact that you made people laugh is a wonderful thing. And that's the nice part about it. You know, it's like I look at people like Tiger Woods and Elvis Presley, and you know, that was a different type of fame. I mean, that was mega fame. The people that stop me every day in airports and what have you just want to say thank you. You know, and basically it's, "Hey, thanks for the laughs. That was a lot of fun." Just makes you feel good that you've done something of significance, and it has a lasting effect.
And why do you think they were so good at guest casting on that show? I mean, if you look at the list, and I know the show was on for, 7 seasons, so there's going to be a lot of guest stars. But the fact that there was the likes of John O'Hurley and Bryan Cranston, and the list goes on and on of just amazing, amazing guest stars and recurring characters. It's very rare, John, and you know this, that stars like to share the spotlight. But on Seinfeld, it seemed like the regulars didn't care that John O'Hurley was stealing an episode or Bryan Cranston was stealing an episode. What was it about that culture there? And I know that's more of a business term.
You know, as Shakespeare once said, the play is the thing. It's the writing. You know, these writers wrote ferociously when they had a guest star on. You know, it was about the idiosyncrasies of that guest star. They weren't there to just open a door and walk in a room and say hi. Or the episode was about their, you know, their neurosis. And it gave the four of them something to react off of. So that's why the writers put so much emphasis into, you know, structuring a written body of work that was hysterical. But remember that Seinfeld was not, and I had to find this out the hard way, Seinfeld was not like any other sitcom. There were no jokes in it, per se. And I found this very awkward in the beginning, because you were kind of waiting for, I mean, I grew up in the world where you set the joke up and punchline. You know, it was like, that was the way modern sitcoms worked. This is different. It was, you play the scene as a drama. You play it at the highest stakes you can possibly play it. And because of that, it's funny. But there's no jokes in there that are funny. It was a peculiar style of humor that had to be learned.
Wow, interesting. So I was out of curiosity, when you were doing the audition for the show, did they guide you? Because I know sort of that Peterman is basically an exaggerated version of John O'Hurley. That's the vibe I get. is that kind of the way you approach it?
They had no idea what they wanted. All they said is, we just want them to sound, and there wasn't really an audition. They gave me the role. It was, they just said, we just want the character to sound the way the catalog is written. As though these words, and the J. Peterman catalog is famous for being something akin to a slice of Hemingway. You know, it's an adventure novel about an Oxford button-down, and it has this peculiar tone to it. It always feels as though you're picking everything up in mid-conversation, and at the end it has a price, a size, and availability. They didn't know what they wanted. They just said, "Say, handed me the catalog," and they didn't really finish the script because they were the most disorganized show on television. But they handed me the J. Peterman catalog and said, "Just get into the reading of it and see what you come up with." And so I was reading through it. It occurred to me that it sounded like a little bit of a 40s radio drama combined with a bit of a bad Charles Kuralt. And that was kind of the origin of the character. Now, his lunacy grew as they started writing more and more of these J. Peterman monologues, where he would just go off on a tangent and never return.
Those are great. I love those. And John, I know that Jerry's been very public about the fact that he can not, he in no way, shape, or form would he ever accept a reunion of any sort, like Friends recently did. And I know he kind of did a mini one with Larry David on Curb a few years ago.
I was supposed to do that, but unfortunately, I was opening my show, the Monty Python show, Spamalot, that night in San Francisco.
Oh.
So I could not. Yeah,
let's put odds on this, John. It's November 2022. Let's say in 10 years, what are the chances of there being somewhat, in one form or other, a Seinfeld reunion? What do you give the chances of that happening?
Zero.
Really?
Zero. And I'll tell you why. The show was successful because it was about selfish 30-year-olds. None of us were nice people. I mean, think about it. There's not a nice person on the show. Everybody would sell each other out and did sell each other out and at one point or another. It doesn't work as a selfish 60-year-old or 70-year-old. It just doesn't, it's not interesting, you know? I think it, Jerry, he begged off at the right time when it was time to go. They had made every statement they could make about that group of people and had exposed every bit of minutiae that they could pick apart.
Interesting. All right. Well, since this is a business podcast, I want to do a little business talk here. You are also, with all the stuff you're doing, the acting, the performing, the dog shows, you own a company called Gold Seal Industries. And I know it's sort of something that I wouldn't expect from you. Like, if I were expecting you an entrepreneur, you'd probably do like a clothing line or even a dog line. But why Gold Seal Industries?
Well, I like, you know, I'm a serial entrepreneur. I have bought and sold companies aside from entertainment that just had wonderful ideas. This is one of the greatest ideas I have ever encountered. And it basically, it's a technology that takes any form of waste and turns it into large amounts of energy. And it can do that. It can process waste with absolute zero emissions. Not only that, it is portable, it is scalable, and it's stackable, and it operates without off the grid. It powers itself. So if you can imagine something the size of a storage container, and actually 5 storage containers to be accurate, being able to process 100 tons of waste a day and producing large amounts of either liquid diesel, jet fuel, anything you want, or electricity or hydrogen, doesn't matter. energy is, we know our physical laws, energy is neither created nor destroyed. It's just simply transferred. It goes from one medium to another. Everything is done, as I said, with zero emissions, and that's never happened before anywhere in the world. And again, it's off the grid, so it powers itself. So we can take care. What it means is we zero out the need for landfills. We zero out the need for sewage treatment. We can do coal with no emissions. So we can, regardless of what our government will tell you, we can do coal with absolute emission-free and producing gasoline right on the spot, right at the coal mine. We can take care of the second tier coal, the stuff that they can't use for burning, but is still an environmental hazard. We can take care of that stuff and still create energy out of that. We can do fracking slurry, the stuff that everybody is complaining about. No problem. You turn it into energy, zero emissions. So it's a pretty profound. I'll tell you another example of what we're doing right now. We're in the process of securing the completion of the contract, but we'll be up there thinning the forests up there in Northern California, where we've had all of those terrible fires over the past 15 years. And it's left all of this residual timber on the ground, which basically is just waiting to be hit by another strike of lightning. And you're left with another fire because nobody's been able to go in there and thin the herd and basically we clean up the forest.
Wow.
Our technology can do that because it's portable, it's scalable, and it's off the grid. So we can go in there and take all that timber and create energy out of it.
And who is your market? Municipalities, government agencies? Who? It's obviously a B2C.
Well, if you think about it, there really isn't. Everything is our market. If you think about it, when a military deploys a base in the middle of nowhere for strategic purposes, what do they have? They have waste. What don't they have? Power. So we supply, you can imagine it'd be wonderful for military encampments. It's wonderful. It'd be wonderful for FEMA, for disasters, by keeping them available. When a tornado comes through, what do they have? Waste. What don't they have? Power. And, we can instantly grind up all of the waste from that's left behind with the tornado, or the hurricane or whatever, and get them back on their feet again with using power and creating gasoline as well.
One thing that I would love to follow up about is, I know you're a conservative, and I know many conservatives aren't big on believing on climate change. Where do you come from with this? Is this more about more from the capitalistic gains of clean energy, or do you have some thoughts about climate change?
Well, my feeling about climate change is the turning of the Earth's temperature this time started back in around 1800, and it's only changed like 0.6th of a degree in that time. So, to say that it's an earth-shattering change is a misnomer. Secondly, the people that are truly polluting in this world is not the U.S. It's Pakistan. It's India. It's Russia, it's China, and they have no plans to change. So it really kind of doesn't matter what we do, if you're looking at it strictly from trying to have a positive impact. The way I approach our technology is that, yes, it's a nice addendum that it's absolute zero emissions and we're not adding any carbon. And of course, it has its carbon credits and all the things that other companies will like to buy into. So that it's a very viable economic pro forma. But it's using something that we are previously not doing, which is getting rid of our waste. We are awash in our waste, and not as much in this country as we are internationally. I mean, they have no idea in the Philippines what to do with their tons and tons and tons of sewage that is just strewn up on the shores there. The plastic, the ocean, or this plastic vortex in all seven of the oceans, nobody has any idea what to do with. We can solve it. It's a very easy solution for what we do. We just take it up, grind it up, put it through, and it's gasoline on the other side. So in terms of climate change, it's not that big of an issue in terms of what I'm doing. Yes, it's a zero emission game, which nobody else can do, and I think that's a positive thing. Mm-hmm. But more importantly is that it is facilitating responsibly the elimination of waste. Because, we create a lot of stuff, but, we don't realize that we leave from the yin and the yang. The yin is the creation of the the product. The yang is the waste that is left behind. Well, nobody cares about that. As long as it just disappears, we don't really care. You know, just, you know, we'll do the same thing that we did 50,000 years ago and our knuckles still scrape the ground. We burn it or we bury it. And we haven't, there's been no advances in the world of waste management at all. There really isn't. There's no, I'll tell you something de facto. There's no recycling. All the stuff that you separate into different containers and it makes you feel good, it's all going to the landfill. Basically, you know, these companies are just real estate agencies. They manage these large plots of land. And they just throw garbage there. And that's what they do. They don't recycle. There is no recycling. At $7 a gallon, you're not moving stuff back and forth.
My take is, you know, I'm a card-carrying liberal from New York, John. So my take on climate change is all of the things that we're doing to slow it down or what have you, it's still a good option as opposed to a negative option. So I'm always about doing things. That's my take on it. Yeah.
And you'll never get me to disagree with you on that. Absolutely. Why not? I mean, there's no reason that we should be putting, because there are ways to do it. We can do it without emissions. Yeah. We have a way to do it. But it's also, I can attach my technology to every single utility company in America. I can attach my technology to every manufacturer in America that's, you know, spewing out waste. We can do it. There's no problem. So it's not a bad idea. It's just the fact that, you know, remember that China is going to be spewing forth the dirtiest coal you've ever seen, and they don't care. They don't care.
It's funny, John, a friend of mine's a conservative, but he's also he owns a clean energy company. And he says, hey, listen, I just stopped racking my brain trying to argue with my conservative friends about climate change. But what I decided to do is, like, I flipped the switch. I was like, I'm no longer talking about climate. I'm talking about how you can make money off clean energy. And it seems like that's sort of like the focus that you're going with. Here's what this technology can do.
Yeah. It isn't really as much of a dollars thing. Yeah, the dollars are there. I mean, This is it's silly money, because when you think of what we're able to do, I'll produce a gallon of diesel at 69 cents a gallon. Well, the wholesale price right now is over $4. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a pretty decent margin. And electricity the same way. I mean, if you talk about doing these units all over the world, you know, the price of electricity is just staggering in some of these third world countries. So, you know, being able to use their waste to offset the cost of energy on the grid, you know, it's enormous.
Yeah. And sort of wondering about your company and competition. Are there other gold seal industries doing something similar or have the same kind of technology? Because I'm wondering what kind of competition you have in this space.
Absolute zero.
Really?
It's as zero as the emissions that we produce.
Wow. Yeah.
Nobody has thought of this. So we are we're a unicorn. There are other people that take waste and turn it into energy, but they have emissions. And they can't do it in the way that we can do it. We have offshoots of the technology for desalination of water, which we have a technology that's never been seen before, that is also, again, off the grid, powers itself and doesn't have any emissions. We don't throw any of the, we produce, instead of just producing water without salt, we produce medical grade water, millions and millions of gallons of it. So it's that technology will be coming along as well.
Wow. Well, I cannot wait to see what happens next with GSI. And lastly, out of me, John, since we're wrapping up on a business question, how often do you get residual checks from Seinfeld? Does it come like once a week, once a month? How does that normally work? I'm really fascinated about that.
Oh, I think they settle up quarterly.
Okay. And is it direct deposit, John, or do you get the check in the mail?
Oh, it's called mailbox money for a good reason.
Awesome. I love it. Well, John O'Hurley, co-founder of Gold Seal Industries, host of the National Dog Show, and a serial entrepreneur. John, this has been a pleasure talking to you. Love hearing about what you're doing there with GSI and the work you're doing with dogs. So thank you very much for taking time. I really appreciate it.
Great to talk with you.
To find out more about John's company, go to goldsealindustries.com and make sure to watch John on the National Dog Show Thanksgiving Day starting at noon on NBC. And that'll do it for this episode of the Forbes Books podcast. If you enjoy the show, make sure you take a second to subscribe so you automatically get new shows when they drop. Also, if you have a minute, I'd love if you left us a review so more amazing entrepreneurs like yourself can discover the show. And please don't forget the golden rule and treat others as you want to be treated. Thanks for listening. Until next time, adios.